Welcome back, everyone, to Flammable Penguins. This week, I grabbed Nick Lewis, our head of art, and I grabbed Neil Richardson again, and we're going to be talking about the balance of art and tech. So, Nick was on, basically, you did all the managing of art for Glow.
Well, it was quite a challenge because it was an entirely new system, so we had an engine which had been purpose-built for it. And it was also a new device for us as well. So it was there were two things there which were particularly tricky, because you had a new engine, which meant people had to get used to it and had to understand all the different problems, the little foibles it may have. And you also had a new device, so even up to the point where you're submitting the game, you're not entirely sure about how it's going to respond. So you have to have a system which is going to be able to be adaptable and be able to make changes right up until the end, right up until submission.
Yeah, because I purpose-built that, and then I handed it over to Neil.
Yeah.
And he had the joy of getting my iPhone code across to Barda and
It wasn't quite me. It was Gary who done that initially. He took it from your engine, ported it into Mortality, and then from being in Mortality, I was the one that had to port it to the device, which wasn't too bad, actually.
So in terms of balancing art and tech, what was the first, what's the lowest end console that you've actually released for?
It sort of goes back. I've been doing it for about 10 years, so it could go back to, 10-year-old PCs.
Did you do the PS1?
Yes. Let me think. PS1. Yeah, I did bits and pieces of PS1, but not an entire project.
You did quite a bit on PS2 there.
Yeah. So did a bit on PS2. So that was probably the lowest stuff that I've done any large-scale production for. They're all different in their own way. So it's really a case of learning how they're going to respond.
Yeah.
So it's really PS1 was the... Well, PSP as well. That was a tricky one.
PSP was a tricky one. And you've written the graphics tech for, a pretty broad range of these from low to high.
The lowest end platform, I'll not include the DS on this because its graphics work totally differently to any of the other consoles I've worked on, but it would... be the PSP. It's just below the PS2 in terms of power.
Would you say the PSP is below the iPhone and the Samsung Wave?
I've never really looked into the technical specs, actually, and I don't know the fill rates or any of all those technical details.
Because one of the things we can say, because the iPhone's quite a public platform, is we can say that textures on the iPhone were a much bigger barrier than we expected.
I think the problem that we have mostly on the iPhone was the number of draw calls.
Yeah.
On the PSP... it seemed to be texture bandwidth a bit more, but texture bandwidth on iPhone and the Barda were an absolute nightmare.
Well, I mean, let's talk about the art and tech balance, because Glow is a really interesting example. I mean, it's a lovely, beautiful, beautiful game. But it started life originally as a very high-level concept for high-end consoles.
Mm-hmm.
We were looking at, the PS3 and the 360 when we were first concepting it.
Mm-hmm.
And the original animatics, which were the two, they were the starting point for when I got into the design. And they were just both so gorgeous and never, ever going to be doable.
Yeah, yeah.
You say never, ever.
Well, I mean, when we decided to go with the iPhone, because, I mean, we had depth of field in there.
I mean, you had the high concept, which was, we were working out. But actually, when I think Samsung, when the competition came along to produce a game on the Barda platform for the Wave, it meant that it seemed a perfect thing, a perfect game to port over to it because of the touchscreen and everything else. So it seemed, and certainly, and again with iPhone as well. So we had to go for gameplay first. We had to say, well, how's it going to respond first?
Nah.
So sacrificing, obviously, there's a lot of stuff you can't get in there. But it was a strong enough concept to be able to work from and adapt, so it worked quite well in the end. It worked pretty well.
Yeah, I mean, the art tech balance is usually about responsiveness. Because, I mean, out of the projects that we work on, generally, I know Neil always aims for 60 frames.
Yeah, will keep it 30, but don't tell anyone.
Yeah.
It must be as close to 60, if possible, get as much, keep as much, what's the word I'm looking for? Basically have enough headroom.
Headroom.
So that it stays at 60, and that means that come the end of a project, you've got a bit more room for adding polish, upscaling a few textures, possibly adding a few more polys here and there. It gives you that extra bit of headroom to put a lot more in towards the end of the project if you can keep above 60, well, if you can keep at 60 with headroom.
Now, speaking about art and tech, there's always a bit of friction between the two because we have two different desires on a project. How much would you say, Neil, how much would you say most programmers, yourself included, lie to the artists about what they can get away with?
I don't lie an awful lot, actually. Okay, quite a bit. I will always try and enforce a lot of restrictions, at least early on in a project, because I know for a fact a lot of the art team, and Nick will probably be able to vouch for me here, will just ignore me completely for a lot of it.
Yeah, it's possible, yeah. Yeah, I've had conversations with people before where I've asked how many polygons are in a particular model, and I'll say, so is that okay? Is that okay with the code team? And then I'll get a response like, well, I've mentioned it. And then you're kind of thinking, well, what you need is a conversation, because we obviously need to negotiate how many polygons we're using and things like that. So I think the conversation at the start is so important. Mm-hmm. And I think it's fine. I think the danger is that if you overshoot and you really do reach for the stars and you put absolutely tons of stuff in, I always go for the benchmark of knowing how much artwork we can put in. We always refer to the coders. The coders always say, this is how much. And in fact, if there is a little bit of adapting the truth there slightly, I don't really mind, because the massive, massive danger is getting to the end of the project, not being able to achieve frame rate, and then having to do very, very badly coordinated and fast cut down in the artwork, which is a total nightmare to manage. It's far, far easier to get to the end of the project and saying that we've got headroom, like you're saying, and saying, right, what can we add in? Because the other way is just an awful, awful system of, you know, I've done it in the past, where you've got 2 or 3 weeks where you're sort of just chopping stuff out randomly. You can't do it in a particularly coordinated way because you've got a deadline to come up against, and the coders have optimized everything as much as they can. So I didn't mind that. And I think also there's the challenge in there, and I think some artists quite like it, in that the challenge of being able to produce artwork that is optimal and that does work to code, and using tricks and things. And I mean, I personally like doing that. I know a few people who do like doing that. And they like having some, you know, restrictions in there to say, look, you know, I can make this look good even though there's all these restrictions in there. So I don't mind that. But the conversation has to be had right at the beginning. So, yeah.
Yeah, with the restrictions, it's very hard because, I mean, you mentioned poly count there, but depending on the device, the restrictions can be quite varied, and sometimes the programmers can't even give a straight answer as to, you know, guidelines, because we're not quite sure, you know, it's a bit of a balancing act, like, throughout the project. So how much do you think the art team should know about how their art fits in technically, like how expensive their piece of art is?
I think they need to know as much as possible. I think sometimes, also because they may have preconceptions about what is heavy in the code. They may think, for instance, I think recently that you get a lot of people chopping down a huge amount of polys out of things, whereas in fact devices, you know, can often handle an awful lot of polys and have trouble with the textures. So sometimes you get people coming in that have that preconception, and they will maybe load too many things into textures, which was more of an old school way of doing things, and cut down an enormous amount of polys, which can be counterproductive, and you sometimes have to reverse that and become a problem. So I think having the knowledge there and saying, look, you need to concentrate on keeping the texture size down, you've got this much leeway in polygons. And I think whatever you do, whenever you start the project, you set out your parameters, you say, this is the kind of poly counts we're working to, these are the texture sizes, and if it's a new platform or a new engine, you make it known to absolutely everybody that, hey, this is like, this is everybody's best guess. This is as good as we can think, you know, as good as we can predict. And so that everybody understands that if there are very big swings and changes in the project, that they knew that right at the beginning. Because nobody's going to be able to predict how it's going to respond at the end of the day.
And the coding can be quite brutal at times. For instance, on Glow, something that I shouted and screamed about, and to be honest, more than I should have, was the color resolution and the palettization of the art. So, Neil, do you want to talk a bit about the misconceptions of color depth and how, you know, as coder, you can actually get a lot out of it?
Well, basically, when I came on Glow, I was got it running on the iPhone. Was thinking to myself, the performance is absolutely abysmal. So I looked into it, I profiled it, and then I looked at the textures and went, we've got 32-bit RGBA textures going through the pipeline here. This is not on. So I had a look at palletizing them, looked at compressing them, but because we were using soft Alvid artwork, it didn't look very good. We had to be very careful with what we actually how much we actually compressed. Thankfully, there's a few tools which are good for doing palletization, which saved us quite a bit of compression there. But few tricks, for example, if you move your soft alpha into the vertices, that means you can remove the alpha from the texture, which allows it to be compressed and palletized far easier.
Yeah, because Glow is such a beautiful game, but it did rely, I mean, the art style that was initially was all this depth of field and blurred and softness and a lot of gradients, all this stuff that programmers hate. Mm. And we actually, now this is an interesting discussion about, should art come first in the design process or should tech come first? Because we actually looked at reworking the entire art style of Glow to try fit tech.
Yeah, I think to a certain extent you have to. I think it comes down to testing. All you can do, I think, is to create your levels or create your artwork and say, you know, this is the best shot. And I think on the art side, often people will push it a little bit to shove it through the pipeline and see, look, hey, how's this going to respond? What's the data we're getting back from this? And I think all you can do is really test it out and say, okay, we've put this many alphas into it, we've put this much, you know, soft edges on things, and test out how it works, and then at least you know the rules of what you're working to. You have an art style to work to. And really, what you need to be able to do is, once you've got a level working, take the data from it, sit down with the art style, sit down with the level that you've created, and say, how can we adapt it? How can we, you know, how can we change a few things and get the best out of it? So I think unless it's very, very extreme, like an incredibly detailed 3D game with all the trimmings that you simply can't fit onto a mobile platform, I think you should, you know, just try and adapt rather than changing the art style itself, and just see where you can fit it in.
Yeah, because in the end, we returned to the original art style, but we did throw around ideas of like really abstract stuff and all crazy things, but we did come back to it in the end.
I think in the initial iPhone development of it, I think some of that came down to management, a lot of that, because we had a very, very definite style which looked really nice. And I think what I learned from that was making sure, just keeping an eye on when people are creating things and making sure they're sticking to that particular style as well, so that everybody's singing from the same hymn sheet. And the real key is to say, here's a concept, here's what you've got on screen, do they look the same? Can you make sure that they are as close as you can possibly get? And I think to a certain extent there was a bit of license taken, a little bit of things changed, which I should have kept an eye on, which didn't, and then that started to spread a little bit. So I think some of that was in the management as well. We did go back to the original style.
I mean, it's tricky stylistically. We talked about this last week with AquaTech. One of the reasons AquaTech's so strong consistently across the board is the fact that there was only one artist. So there's no real room for deviation because there's only one brain on it. Mm. But I mean, we get the same thing on code as well, where different programmers will have different ideas. And
it can cause arguments as well,
yes.
Which you were trying to spark up when we were in here with Tim.
Yes, they're good fun. They are good fun, but I think the programmers' arguments are possibly louder than the artists'.
Yeah.
But with the glow art style, as you said, there's certain tricks and stuff. And sometimes the solution can be rather programmer heavy. I'm thinking, for instance, we have winter levels and we have these ice blocks and we have the snow in there. And we couldn't come up with an artistic solution that didn't look very, very gamey and basically broke the style. And then Graham and Bruce came up with this idea of doing these fractal, like, ice, you know, breaking them up. How often do you find it's 100% art, and how often do you find the programmer step in? And I know Neil's also got very strong views on this.
I think it's a case of we looked at that and we looked at what the potential problems could be. And often, again, it's a case of putting things in and trying them out. And when we were getting, well, it was Rick originally who was looking at things, looking at the icicle style of things. And what I said to him initially, because it was really difficult art task, there was obviously going to be some procedural basis for it, and that would have been the ideal solution. And how much of it is programmed and how much of it is art is really often based on how much time each of the teams have, and how you prioritise it. If there are fundamental problems or fundamental things that you need to do to just simply get the game working, you may not have a coder who's ready to be able to do something in special effects. So you have to rely on the art, which can be a little bit clunky and a little bit sort of roundabout. But what I usually do to say to people is, if they have an effect that they want to achieve, then they make an example file, they suggest trying it out, they send that with a detailed detailed description of how they want it to work to the code team. And it's a far better way of saying it than just sending an email saying, hey, look, how are we going to do this? I haven't a clue, because everybody else will say, great, I've got another problem that I've got to look at. It's far, far easier to say, somebody comes up with a solution which may be imperfect. But often what that does, it sparks a debate and people say, okay, there's a solution, it's not very good. And often what we find is the coders then come in and say, hey, look, you don't want to do it like that, it's going to be bloody awful. So you want to be able to make sure that then the coders come in and we get a solution that works. And we've done that on a couple of games. We've said, you know, art's come up with a solution. They'll say, look, this is the fallback, this is imperfect, what can the coders do? This is what we're trying to get to. And then often if there's the time to do it, then the coders will come in and do something really nice.
Yeah, because you have a viewpoint with programmatic and data-driven.
Yeah, but I'd prefer everything to be as data-driven as possible. The programmers should be giving the artists as much flexibility as possible without sacrificing performance. A good example of this is the amount of effects that Nikia achieves with just UV scrolling, basically.
Good old UV scrolling.
Everyone loves the UV scrolling.
Fantastic.
And another example is, it was on Ultimate Board Games Collection for the Wii.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of people, when doing cell shading, will go, when they're programming in OpenGL, will go, oh, I need to do this, that, and the other. Nick just gave us some models that just happened to work with a little trick he learned back on. What was that game you worked on again?
It was Futurama that I worked on a few years ago. Yeah, so basically the cell shading, when we saw that on Futurama, we had somebody who was coding the cell shading. They're having real difficulties because you're having to look from the camera viewport. You're trying to draw edges. Some of those edges you want to see. Some of them start to encroach around the actual model itself, and they weren't working particularly well. And then somebody either found it on the web or they came up with themselves, just took all the faces, extruded them out through the normals, reversed them around, and then you just get the black cell shading effect. And it's just an effective way. So again, that's kind of the reverse of what I was talking about there, which is code problem which is really heavy, and then an art problem where instead of having a conversation about it, people just get on and do it, and then just go, here's my solution, how about this? And then, you know,
I like to see it when, for example, if you give me a model and animation and effect in World Sports Party, the power-ups with the glowing backgrounds, absolutely no code involved in them. It was just purely with our animation system and our material system, setting up the correct sort orders, putting everything into the right layers and setting up the right blending modes. Mm. There's no need to do a lot of this in code. I mean, for particles and things where there needs to be a lot of optimization done, yes, keep it in code. But if it can all be done in artwork, it's absolutely fantastic, because it means an artist can just come up with an effect and pretty much just drop it straight into the game without even needing to get a programmer to deal with it. They just drop it in. There's a replacement animation. They can see it immediately in the game. If it turns out to be too slow, an effects programmer can then take it and port it and make it more programmatic.
Yeah, I mean, I want to come back to those effects, but before I do, it was just the point of the cell shading and the UV scrolling. Now, the cell shading, just to reiterate, was that you extrude the model, you invert the faces, and then you rely on basically culling faces to get this nice outline effect. Now, UV scrolling is something we use a lot.
Yeah.
it's a favorite trick of Nick's. And UVs are the texture coordinates on a texture, and then basically what we do is we animate those UVs.
Yeah.
And we can do some wonderful tricks. We can do facial expressions by flicking it really fast. I mean, again, coming back to Futurama, you did quite a bit of the actual, I believe it was something to do with faces or something. You did quite a bit of
UV. Oh, yeah, we did that. We did the eyes. We did the pupils of the eyes. We had a real problem because if you create a physical pupil, you had to bring it somewhere off the surface to avoid any
Z bias
stuff. You had some real problems with that. So actually creating a texture and of a black dot with a white background and shifting the UV coordinates of it just meant that you could move it obviously up, down, left, right. And if you were to attach those to the 0 to 1 coordinates of the UVs and attach those to the physical locator in space and attach the properties of the UVs to the XY coordinates, you can move the locator around and then the eyes would follow quite well. So that worked quite well. I mean, my favourite so far, which I saw the other day, was making a reflection. Now, we tried a reflexive gem, which was a texture reflection. Just scroll the UVs left and right as you move the camera left, right, and it looks like it's reflecting. And that's for something just for mainly 2D stuff, which works quite well.
I mean, and programmers love the UV scrolling because it's so cheap.
Well, I don't really need to do a lot. It works natively with our animation system. It's one matrix for it.
Yeah, it's really, really cheap. So coming back to the authored nature, when things are data-driven, when an artist is doing it 100%, it does have a much more authored quality, and that can lead to either style problems, but it can also lead to a much more personal and polished touch. How do you get that authoring to be consistent?
It's really tricky. We had some problems. What you have to do is, if you've got the strong concept art, you have to give people enough freedom to be able to make. You've got to be able to give people the sort of the boundaries to work within and say this is the style of this. So if you've got mood boards and you've got your concept art, you have to be able to say this is what you're working within, to give people enough freedom to make it interesting for them, so they're not copying something verbatim. But the danger is if you give people too much freedom and maybe they're not so experienced, then it becomes a bit of a problem because their particular style starts to creep in. Even on very, very definite styles, I've seen this on previous games, where the other person's style has started to creep into it. So it's a really fine balance. And it comes down to a lot of the time the quality of the artists themselves to be able to envisage how someone else's vision and be able to adapt their artwork within it. But you can demoralise people as well if you really keep hitting them hard and say, look, it's got to look like this, it's got to look like this all the time, then it can be quite demoralising for people. So people have to have as much information as possible about the design. And the general rule of thumb is the lack of concept art and the lack of information you give to artists about how things should look, the more awry things are going to go. It's just like, not that artists are sheep, but it's kind of like a flock of sheep. You've got to have plenty of control, otherwise they'll all start to go off in different directions. And it's not their failing, it's management failing, because they need to know what things are supposed to look like and the feel of the game. So, every single plant, every single object in the game needs to have images for people to work from, basically.
Oh, that's very, very interesting. The thing with the authored quality that programmers constantly have to do is many, many times the artists are lacking the direct feedback or the tools or the simple situations. I'll run through a quick few. Like recently, we were working with shaders, trying to get Maya shaders to match in-game shaders, a very, very tricky thing. In Glow, we had the level, trying to get the level editor to match what was in-game. And worst case scenario, you've got artists who basically have to build the asset, get it into the game, and then look it into the game before they can actually, you know, CSMA adjustments. So, Neil, how do we eliminate this, and how do we make it easier for the artists really to just do their work?
Toolchain, something that we lack currently is a nice world editor, something that the artists can preview live in, which is why recently when we've been working on the PS3, I've basically took what the artists can do, which is Lambert shader, Blind shader, Fong shader, so on, implemented a subset of the parameters that those provide, which allows an artist to basically look at a scene in Maya, and if all goes well, load it in-game and it should look identical. But you can't have the game look completely different to in Maya. If you do, you really want to have a world editor to load in and preview first. We did used to have a viewer for this, but that has since deviated.
But I mean, even with the tool chain, I've never seen a studio where every single artist has a test kit. And so often the device, the target device you're developing for, has just a different look and feel than the PC. Like, for instance, when we're working on a mobile device or when we're working on something that has graphics capabilities that the PC doesn't. Is that something we should try bridge, or is it just a time sink?
Try and make all the platforms look as close to each other as possible. For example, an Xbox 360, a PS3, and a PC, a high-end PC, you should be able to manage this quite a lot. There'll be slight differences. They'll never be 100% perfect due to optimizing your shaders. PS3, putting everything onto SPUs, the math is going to be a little bit different. It's not going to look identical, but it's going to look pretty damn close. But never, ever limit yourself to the lowest common denominator. For example, if you're developing a game that's also going to be on PSP, don't make it all look like the PSP just because that's your lowest common denominator. You need to actually sometimes just preview it on a device.
Yeah. Now, I already mentioned to Nick about how much tech an artist should know, but how much art should a programmer know?
If they're going to be working with an artist, they need to know as much of the terminology as possible. I'm still learning. If possible, they should dig into the tools. For example, Nick knows I can competently put a few boxes together in Maya.
Yeah,
that's about
good.
My limitations. I know how to set up the shaders. Basically, anything I need to do in Maya, I can get away with most of it. Otherwise, I need to run to Nick and go, help, help.
I mean, it is a problem with programmers and artists in that a lot of art tools use non-standard terminology or use a form of terminology that doesn't appear in
Instance.
Code.
That horrible, dreaded word.
Instance. But, you know, materials, shaders, all these words have a lot of, we don't have a solid definition. So it can cause communication problems. Mm. You know, how do you work around those? I mean,
I think it comes. It's really got to be the flow of information, and I think creating it comes down to in some ways like a basic level where people have to be able to talk to each other anyway, which comes down to also the atmosphere right down to the atmosphere in the office, in terms of people being able to talk to each other, having those conversations and understanding as much as possible means that. Often the most powerful solutions are the combination of code and art. So an artist can understand, or hears a conversation, even overhears a conversation in programming, and understands some of it and says, well, I can do some of that in art, and vice versa. So they're usually very, very powerful combinations. So if you can get artists and coders to understand each other and understand each other's processes as best as possible, it's always going to be an advantage. But you know, people aren't going to be able to. People learn at different rates and are interested in different things. So the main thing is just to make sure they're talking to each other all the time. And I think a lot of the success of whether a game's going to be successful or have problems or not is often comes about with you can usually see see it by watching the amount of time people actually get up and cross the room and talk, where the artists go and talk to the coders and vice versa. And using email stuff is a bit lazy because everyone sits next to each other anyway. But usually the people who are actually running around the room a bit, walking and talking to the coders, often they have far, far fewer problems because they're not sending emails that just get left. And they're actually having conversations and coming up with solutions, which is you know, the most effective way of doing it.
Yeah, I mean, it's, as I say, I make fun of the program artist divide, but the project does go smoothest when it's a very tight niche. One of our solutions to this problem that we actually mentioned in the Testers podcast, because it's often a bouncing ball between whether it's an artist's fault or whether it's a programmer's fault. And sometimes it's very difficult to find that out. So at the end of World Sports Party, what we actually did is we did the blame game. We just named someone who it was their fault for the day. It was sort of mocking, but it was an attempt to sort of diffuse that that problem.
It's good because you've got to diffuse that. And I think there's... Everybody's responsible for the solution. That's the main thing, whether it's art or code. And what I've usually said to artists is if there's a problem that comes up and it's a question of whether it's their art or a coder, the artist has to make every effort to say that their work is as clean as possible and say, I've done literally everything that I can to fix this problem. And then they can go to a coder with a completely clean conscience and say, look, I know this looks fine to me. And then it just means the conversations are a lot easier, because otherwise if you get somebody who's saying, yeah, there could be this, there could be that, you don't want a coder to spend 3 days trying to solve a problem simply because somebody's been a bit lazy about the naming conventions or the artwork itself. You want to say, no, this is as clean as I can get it. You know, I've tried to solve this problem, and then pass it back to code, and then you can have a look at it. And maybe it bounces backwards and forwards a few times, but so long as it's a process trying to solve it between the two, I think that's the main.
This is one of the reasons that I actually got Maya installed on my machine, was because I could then import the artwork without having to trawl through the XML.
Yeah.
Going, what's named? Is this named correctly? Because you've probably heard me a lot of times go, it's your fault, not mine, not my fault. Half an hour later, yeah. I'll swallow my pride and go, sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I've got the reverse problem where on a personal project, I was convinced it was a code problem. I refused to blame the art, and I wasted a week.
Yeah.
And it was just the bind pose on the animation had gotten.
Yeah. It's the danger of the wasted time, and it comes down to finance, and it comes down to getting projects done at the end of the day.
Yeah.
If an artist hasn't, say, named things correctly, if they don't go back and look at the naming conventions, the way things are built, if a coder spends 3 days on it, that's a lot of money wasted simply because somebody just didn't check that things were named correctly. And a lot of these things can be pretty easy to look at. So that's why it's done, because otherwise you can waste an awful lot of time.
Yeah. The other common thing that we both share in art and code is early optimization is evil.
Yeah, yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think it's one of the things about having to be agile within production is getting tangible reasons for optimizing and testing all the time. Because you can cut things down and then have no benefit from it. And so
Okay. Well, I mean, because Neil constantly hits me over the head for me wanting to optimize early.
Well, you know how I work with optimization. It comes in waves throughout the project, but it's keep an eye on the big picture, make sure everything's fine. When it starts hitting a point where you need to worry, have a quick gloss over everything, and spend maybe an hour or two just profiling quickly optimizing. Okay, it's back to 60, move on.
Yeah, it's testing and profiling and working off actual information rather than just gut feeling. So we're going to have to wrap it up there. Before we wrap it up, Neil, what would be your one key advice to any programmer, especially newer programmers who are coming into a studio or who are on a project, or even older programmers, on dealing with art and dealing with the art team?
Learn what tools that the artists you're going to be working with use, if at all possible. Get a student copy of it and become familiar with it, just even if it's just moving the camera around or dropping a cube into a scene or being able to draw simple texture. If you become familiar with the tools and some of the terminology, it can really speed up communication.
Okay, cool. And Nick, someone who's coming, an artist who's coming into a team or an artist who's been in a team, what would your primary advice for getting on with the Code Monkeys be?
I think it just comes down to there's a natural idea of this division between art and code, and not to sound like a total peacenik, but I think it's the fact that all the problems are everybody's. It's everybody's problem. Everybody needs to come up with a solution, and is communication. Always talk to the coders. Always talk about the work and how you can solve problems. And problems are for everybody, and so everybody needs to come up with solutions. So it's about having the conversation all the time, and ignore anybody, even if they've been in the industry for years and years, telling you that there's any sort of divide between coders and artists. Because if you get into that frame of mind, it's not going to go very well.
It doesn't need to be at all.
No.
Okay, well, I think that's a very positive to end on there. Thanks again to Nick Lewis and Neil Richardson for joining me. And give us feedback on the blog post, on the website, or just catch me on Twitter on Evil Kamau. And this is a Flammable Penguins podcast signing off. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.